This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. In the early days of Barack Obama's first presidential campaign, he gave a speech at a gala for an organization called Kids in Distressed Situations. At the time, U.S. politics were focused largely on the federal deficit, but he wanted to turn the conversation to a different kind of shortage.
If we hope to meet the moral test of our times, if we hope to eradicate child poverty or AIDS or joblessness or homelessness or any of the other issues that were chronicled before I came on stage, then I think that we're going to have to talk more about the empathy deficit, the ability to put ourselves in somebody else's shoes, to see the world through somebody else's eyes.
A recent study out of the University of Michigan reveals that empathy, the ability to figuratively put oneself in the shoes of another, has been on the decline since the 1980s, with the steepest drop occurring just in the past 10 years. So what's the cause of this drop-off in empathy, and what can we do to reverse the trend? Roman Krznarek is a writer, philosopher, and founding faculty member of the School of Life in London. His latest book is Empathy: Why It Matters and How to Get It. Roman, welcome back to the program.
Thanks very much for having me on.
The vast majority of human beings, you write, 98%, are born to empathize and wired for social connection. So what exactly is the purpose of empathy? What is the, I guess, evolutionary advantage?
Well, it is extraordinary that over the last 300 years, we've been basically told by our culture that we're self-interested creatures.
Right.
But neuroscience research in the last 10, 20 years has told us that we are wired for empathy and social cooperation. As you said, you know, 98% of us have the ability to step into other people's shoes and look through their eyes. And it's an evolutionary adaptation, according to primatologists and evolutionary biologists. Just think that as groups, human beings had to survive and cooperate together in order to protect themselves from predators, in order to share food in times of scarcity. They required empathy, that ability to understand other people's feelings and needs. And just think of a parent with their child. You know, anybody who's had a baby, you know, will respond to their baby's cry. It's a way of keeping us surviving, you know, as a species. So empathy is deeply built into our mammalian self.
And that 2%, the folks that can't feel empathy, I guess that's what divides what we consider normal folks from psychopaths.
That's right. Amongst those 2% are the psychopaths or sociopaths who find it very difficult to not only step into other people's shoes, but to really feel other people's feelings. Because when it comes down to it, if you look in a psychology textbook, there's two kinds of empathy. There's one kind called affective empathy. That's where you feel what other people feel. So if you see anguish on a child's face and you too feel anguish, that's affective empathy. And then there's what's called cognitive or perspective-taking empathy, where you really try to imagine what's it like to be another person. You know, to be a homeless guy sleeping out on a cold winter's night, what's it like to be walked past by people without even looking you in the eye? And this affective and cognitive empathy, most of us have both of them, though there's a tiny percentage that don't.
Now, tell me a little bit, because when I was younger, I often grappled with the distinction between sympathy and empathy. Can maybe you just explain a little bit what separates the two?
I'm glad you asked that question, because there's a lot of confusion about it. You know, if you look on an anguished child's face and you feel, as I said, the same emotion as them, like you feel anguish too, that's what's called empathy, particularly affective empathy. But if you look on that child's face and you feel a different emotion, for example, pity, or you feel sorry for them, you think, oh, the poor little thing, that's what's called sympathy. Sympathy is an emotional response, but one that isn't shared. And actually, sometimes sympathy just isn't enough. You can feel sorry for someone, but not actually know what they really need. And if you think about my children, if I think about them, I've got twins, a boy and a girl. And when they're about 1.5, before their empathy had kicked in, they could actually sympathize. So when my son was crying, his sister would try and comfort him with her favorite toy dog, which was a kind and sympathetic gesture, but not a lot of use to him. Fast forward a year, when they're about 2.5 and their empathy had kicked in, when my son was crying, his sister would try and comfort him with his favorite toy cat. That's the imaginative leap of empathy, really understanding somebody else's perspective.
So you've talked about empathy being on the decline worldwide, and especially in the U.S. So what does a world without empathy look like? What is at stake here?
What does a world without empathy look like? it looks like Germany in the 1930s and early 1940s.
Okay, that's not good.
That isn't good. You know, the Nazis were brilliant at eroding empathy for Jews, homosexuals, for gypsies, Roma people. They took away their humanity so people didn't see them as individual human beings. When you erode empathy, you can treat somebody as a non-person. Famously, there was a philosopher called Martin Buber who made this distinction between an I-thou relationship and an I-it relationship. A bit tricky to understand, but what he meant was that when you treat someone as an equal and you treat them as a full human being, you step into their shoes, look through their eyes, that's what he called an I-thou relationship. And an I-it one is when you treat someone as an object, not really as a full human being. And in Nazi Germany or segregation in the United States, for much of the 20th century, people were treated as its.
While reading your book, it's hard not to look at the state of empathy in decline and connect it maybe to the state of narcissism, which seems to be seeing an opposite upward trend. And a lot of people connect the narcissism that we're seeing to social media. So is this a case where you're looking at empathy and you're saying social media, we're talking about Facebook, Twitter, are these the things that are driving this downward trend for empathy?
It certainly looks like that social media is a major factor in eroding our empathic capacities and sending empathy in America into free fall. We all know, and there's a lot of research on this, that the more Facebook clicks you have, the more narcissistic you're likely to be. People are constantly obsessed with updating their profiles and making themselves look perfect. And in many ways, social media is feeding narcissistic selves. On the other hand, we know that social media has been a tool used by the Occupy movement and the Arab Spring to spread powerful emotions like anger and empathy. Someone could take a photograph of a young girl in Tehran being shot by security forces, and within hours, millions of people knew who she was through Facebook and other social media. So social media isn't all bad. It's just we're not very good at using it. Mostly social media has been designed for the efficient exchange of information rather than intimacy.
Yeah, there's an anecdote that you write about in the book, talking about the website Chat Roulette, which is, you know, we could do a whole show on that. It's quite the odd beast. But you know, it's the sort of thing where conceptually this could be used to really increase empathy. We're talking about talking with strangers, being connected with anybody in the world at any given time. And that is something that could really drive up empathy. But the way that people use it, it just seems to have the opposite effect.
That's right. You mentioned their Chat Roulette, which is a website started by a Russian teenager where anyone with a webcam can use it, and you press the button when you go on to the site and you immediately spun randomly into a living room anywhere from Murmansk to Minnesota, and you can talk to the person whose webcam is on about anything. The problem with Chat Roulette, which you would think would be an amazing way for us to connect with strangers from different cultures and overcome empathic and social divides, the problem with Chat Roulette is people click the next button every 2 seconds and is full of pornography. It's really quite filthy. But I think with a few tweaks, you could probably turn Chat Roulette into something pretty good. If you gave it a new name like Empathy Connect, that would help. And maybe perhaps if each time you spun yourself into someone's room online, a menu of conversational questions came up, which could be a basis for a real, genuine conversation.
Well, then aside from maybe changing the way that we're using social media, changing our habits, what are some other steps that we can take as individuals to really cultivate our inner empath?
Well, the first thing to do, I think, is to practice empathic listening. Everyone's been in situations, they're arguing with their partner, their husband or their wife, and they just thought, oh gosh, I wish I could just understand. They could just understand where I'm coming from, how I'm feeling. What are you asking for? Empathy, right? You want them to step into your shoes, if only for a moment. Now, to practice empathic listening in a relationship, you need to do two things. If you're in a tense situation arguing with someone, whether at home or in the office, you need to listen out for, firstly, what are their feelings, and secondly, what are their needs. Give them the space to articulate their feelings and needs without interrupting them, and it is extraordinary how it reduces the tension. There's a really great statistic, which is that in employee-employer disputes, in labor disputes, if both sides agree before they sit down to talk, to literally repeat what the other side just said before they start speaking themselves, you reach conflict resolution 50% faster. Now that's empathic listening really working for us.
I'm talking about empathy with Roman Krznarek, philosopher, writer, and author of Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It. Well, movies and books can only accomplish so much, and you write a lot about having empathy adventures. One example is this experience called Dialogue in the Dark. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is?
Dialogue in the Dark is an experiential empathy immersion. It's a global network of museums that give you the experience of what it's like to be visually impaired, to be blind. And you walk in and you're given a blind stick, a cane, and a visually impaired guide takes you through an experience of total darkness for 65 minutes. And it's much more extreme than those management training sessions you can do where you put on a blindfold for 5 minutes. This is whether you have your eyes open or shut, it makes no difference. And you go into the Dialogue in the Dark and you do things like you cross a busy street which has obstacles in the way, like a badly parked motorbike. You go on to a subway station, have to click through your ticket in complete darkness. You follow the voice of your guide to the bar and there's a blind barman and you fumble around with your coins and notes and you sit and have a drink, a beer or a glass of wine, whatever you like, with your guide and talk to them. And it's extraordinarily impactful. And in fact, over 7 million people have been to these Dialogue in the Dark exhibits, which have popped up as pop-up museums in over 130 cities in 30 countries. And it's a really great way of doing a bit of experiential empathy. I mean, it just doesn't, it's not something you ever forget.
What about for those of us who see maybe patterns in our own behavior where, you know, for example, I often find it very easy to empathize with strangers, but I actually have a tougher time empathizing with people with whom I've had a long history, my family or certain friends. Sometimes, you know, you build those relationships and you feel that the empathy can actually become harder as you get to know someone down the road. I don't know if this makes any sense to you, but I guess it's sort of interesting to think, you know, a stranger versus a family member versus a friend versus a coworker.
It is interesting that often it's in families where there are the biggest empathic deserts, where you may well not have spoken to your sibling for years, or people find it hard to talk to their parents or grandparents and things like that. And that's quite normal because, of course, we get into habits, into bad habits, where we fail to practice the art of conversation. So how do you break those habits, really, is the question. And it's very difficult, but I think the beginning point of that is vulnerability. By making yourself vulnerable, by talking about your own feelings, how you feel, and then giving the other person the space to express their vulnerability, you start a dance, which is the beginning of a conversation. It can be very difficult, but you need to let the other person speak and be open, but also do it yourself to sometimes start out the conversation, because without that, it can really go nowhere. So we need to learn to take off our masks, make ourselves vulnerable as the beginning of creating an empathic dialogue. But of course, it is really very, very difficult. Sometimes it is impossible. And in the end, you know, we often do give up. But I mean, even just a tiny example in my own life, you know, my father and I very rarely spoke very openly or emotionally with each other. You know, I've always loved him very much, but I sometimes didn't feel that close to him. And so I actually started interviewing him about his life. And I spent 7 years doing it, not continuously, but every year I'd record a bit of his life story. And I tried to make it a conversation. And after the 3rd year, he really started opening up emotionally. We talked about my mother's death when I was 10 years old. He cried in front of me. He'd never done that before. And I did as well. And it was through that slowly building up conversation and drawing on its power that we started rekindling our relationship.
Well, Roman, you've been having this conversation about empathy. You've been, you know, traveling around, talking to many, many people. You've even got the idea for the Empathy Connect sort of chat roulette empathy site. Are you thinking about taking anything that you've been learning about this and really putting it into action through a project or anything like that?
Absolutely, I am. In fact, I think we need to create new empathic cultural institutions. And the one I'm currently working on is founding the world's first empathy museum. And in fact, it's going to launch in London in mid-2015, but it's going to be an international traveling exhibition, and I hope to bring it to the United States as well. And what will happen is you can go along and you will have empathy conversations and experiences. So you'll go there and there may well be a human library where you can borrow people for conversation. You go into another room and there's a cell phone assembly line and you put on a sweatshop worker's overalls as if you're in a Chinese sweatshop and you try and put together a cell phone under sweatshop labor conditions. Go into another room and there might be a brain booth that measures your personal empathy levels. And so this is going to be launching an online as well at empathymuseum.com.
Well, we'll make sure to have a link on our website. And Roman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me on the program.
Roman Krznarek, philosopher, writer, founding faculty member of the School of Life in London. His latest book is Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It. And you'll find a link to his book as well as a link to articles and videos that explore the subject in depth at our website. That's at wordofmouthradio.org.